Okay, my name is Peter Sandman. It's spelled S-A-N-D-M-A-N. There are people in my family who say Sandman, but I don't. I haven't got a title. I'm a risk communication consultant. What I usually tell journalists to say is risk communication consultant based in Princeton, New Jersey.
There we go.
All right. Well, I mean, the risk communication is basically three different skills. When a risk is dangerous and people are ignoring it, people are apathetic, the task of risk communication is essentially to scare them, to shake them by their collective lapels and say, look here, this is dangerous, do something. That's risk communication, and it certainly applies to vaccination because there are lots of people with regard to lots of vaccines who are insufficiently concerned about the disease and don't get vaccinated or don't vaccinate their children for that reason. The second kind of risk communication is exactly the opposite. When people are upset about a risk, more upset than the data justify, and the job of risk communication is to reassure them rather than to alarm them. And that also applies to vaccines, because there's a growing group of people who are anxious about the safety of vaccines. Their problem, they don't get vaccinated, but the reason they don't get vaccinated isn't that they're insufficiently worried about the disease, it's that they're excessively worried about the vaccine. So that's also a risk communication problem that affects vaccination. The third kind of risk communication is when people are rightly upset about a risk that's genuinely serious. And then, you know, you're not trying to increase how upset they are as you are in the first kind. You're not trying to decrease how upset they are as you are in the second kind of risk communication. You're trying to help them bear it, and you're trying to help them make wise rather than unwise decisions. That also applies to vaccination in a crisis situation. If you've got an epidemic or a pandemic of an infectious disease, and you're suddenly urgently vaccinating millions of people, and you're trying to help them get through this very difficult situation. So all three of the dominant paradigms in risk communication arise with regard to vaccination issues.
Got it. Now, I know
you can tell I don't do short answers very well,
that's going to be
your problem.
That's fine. That's terrific.
I'm not a soundbite kind of guy.
When
I talk about risk communication, I make a distinction between two aspects of risk. One of the aspects of risk, which I call hazard, is how serious it is technically. How likely is it to kill people or hurt people or damage ecosystems? The other aspect of risk, which I call outrage, is how serious is it socially? How likely is it to upset people, to make people angry or frightened? And the formula that sent my children to college and will probably send my children to my grandchildren to college is risk equals hazard plus outrage. That is, both the technical seriousness of a risk and the social seriousness of a risk are part of what risk means to people. Now, based on that formula, you can identify the three main kinds of risk communication. If hazard is high and outrage is low, your problem is that people are not concerned enough about a risk that's technically serious. And your job is to alarm them, to shake them by their collective lapels and say, look here, this is dangerous, do something. And that obviously applies to vaccination because there are lots of apathetic people. Lots of hazard about particular infectious diseases, not enough outrage. In the opposite corner of the hazard versus outrage map, if outrage is high and hazard is low, then your problem is that people are excessively alarmed about a risk that's small. That also applies to vaccination because there's a growing group of people who are not so much insufficiently concerned about the disease, they're excessively concerned about the vaccine. So they don't get vaccinated not because of apathy, not because of insufficient outrage, but because of excessive outrage. And, you know, so you have to manage the outrage down about the vaccine instead of managing the outrage up about the disease. That's also, you know, so that's also a vaccination problem. The third kind of risk communication, the third corner of the hazard versus outrage map, is when hazard and outrage are both high. And that's a public health crisis. People are upset because, you know, you've got a pandemic, you've got an epidemic, you've got a major outbreak of an infectious disease. People are very upset, and they're right to be very upset. You know, their neighbors are dying in the streets. And then you have a health crisis. And if you have a vaccine that's capable of dealing with that health crisis, then crisis communication arises with regard to vaccines. The fourth corner, low hazard, low outrage, there isn't any communicating to be done. I mean, if people are apathetic about a risk that's not serious, you know, what would you say to them? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. So that, you know, that doesn't apply to vaccination. It doesn't apply to anything. Well, there are two predominant vaccine conversations with the public. One, which is the low outrage, high hazard problem, is how do you get people more worried about infectious diseases? People used to be very worried about infectious diseases, and we made sufficient progress with regard to the deadliest diseases that there are very few people left in the United States, plenty in other parts of the world, but very few people left in the United States who are actively worried about measles or actively worried about polio or actively worried about all the infectious diseases that our grandparents found terrifying. So persuading people to get their vaccines, to get vaccinated and get their children vaccinated, comes up against, you know, apathy, inexperience, just the failure to realize that these diseases are still dangerous. They haven't been eliminated, although we're close on polio. They haven't been eliminated, and there's a genuine hazard to your family and to yourself and to your neighbors if you don't get vaccinated. And, I mean, my sense is, frankly, that conversation is pretty well done. It's a slog. It's an endless challenge. There's a new generation of apathetic people every generation. So it's never over. But public health people know how to do it. They're very good at doing campaigns, the goal of which is to arouse people's awareness about a disease and about the importance of getting vaccinated against that disease. So that's a major job, but it's a job they do pretty well. The second conversation, and this is the one I think that public health people do much less well, in fact, I think they do it terribly, is the conversation with people where the problem is too much outrage rather than too little outrage. It's not too much outrage about the disease, it's too much outrage about the vaccine. There's a growing group of people in the United States, in Europe, and increasingly in other parts of the world as well, who are concerned that vaccines may not be safe. And that concern takes lots of forms, and you know we may talk about that later if you want to. But the main issue then is if you're a public health professional and you're very accustomed to reaching out to apathetic people and trying to persuade them the disease is serious, but you may not be at all accustomed to reaching out to people who are suspicious and skeptical, who don't trust you, who are worried about the safety of the vaccine, and when you say to those people that the disease is serious, you're not addressing their interests at all. They already know the disease is serious, but they think the vaccine is more serious, or they're worried the vaccine might be more serious. So there's a whole other conversation that has to be had addressing people's concerns about vaccine safety. And I think it's a rare public health professional who does that well. The question of how people came to be skeptical about vaccines and anxious about vaccines, I mean, there are lots of pieces to that story, and there are probably some pieces I'm not aware of. But some of the pieces are pretty obvious. I mean, one thing is infectious diseases are much less serious in our lives than they once were, or at least the traditional ones. Are much less serious in our lives than they once were. There was considerable discussion during the swine flu pandemic last year about whether the swine flu vaccine, the H1N1 vaccine, was safe. That discussion simply wouldn't have happened if the swine flu pandemic had been extremely severe. Hundreds of thousands of people had been dying instead of a much smaller number of people, folks would have been lining up around the corner to get vaccinated. But because the pandemic was mild, because most infectious diseases, our experience of most infectious diseases is we don't know anyone who died of measles. We don't know anyone who died of rubella. We don't know anyone who died of whooping cough. So we don't know anyone who died of flu, or maybe we know a great grandparent who died of flu. But we don't have a lot of experience with these infectious diseases being deadly. We can afford to focus on the safety of the precaution, rather than the safety of the thing it's a precaution against. So that's one thing that's going on. Another thing that's going on is obviously, we are in a period where suspicion and skepticism about all authorities is increasing. So it's not surprising that people don't trust, the CDC as much as they used to. They don't trust any arm of the government as much as they used to. We still trust the CDC more than we trust the CIA, but it's part of the same government, and we have a sense that probably a very healthy sense that government is not to be trusted. But I think the biggest factor, and the most important factor, and the most changeable factor, the one we can do the most about, is that public health has earned suspicion. It has earned mistrust by being less than completely candid. The problem, and this is a very, very common problem in risk communication. It comes up with my corporate clients all the time. So it's not surprising that it comes up in public health as well. The problem is, if you're, let's say you're 95% right on some issue, and it doesn't have to be a public health issue. You can be a company with a factory, and your factory is emitting dimethyl meatloaf out your stacks, and you're 95% right about the safety of your emissions or the safety of your vaccine. It's very similar issues. Public health people don't like to think that they're similar issues, but they are very similar issues. You're 95% right, but you have opponents. You have critics. And if you acknowledge the 5% that's problematic, if you acknowledge that, all right, there's a little bit of case here that this is dangerous, there's some reason to think that this is dangerous, not much. It's certainly less dangerous than the disease, but it's not entirely safe. The evidence isn't 100% on your side. It's only 95% on your side. Yeah. But if you admit the other 5%, you're terribly afraid that your critics will seize on it. They'll emphasize it. The sensational media will pay too much attention to it. You're afraid, the 95% of the truth that's on your side is going to get lost in the 5% that's on the other side. So you suppress the other side. You ignore the 5%. You pretend that 95% right is 100% right. And you're not doing that to mislead people. You're doing that to lead people. You're afraid the 5% is going to mislead people. So you leave it out to keep the story clear and to keep the story straightforward and to avoid confusing people with that minority of the information that might lead them in what you consider to be the wrong direction. That's an honorable impulse, but it's a really stupid impulse. Because what happens is you suppress the 5%. Sometimes you lie about it. More often you ignore it, or you don't emphasize it much. It's on your website in some very technical corner of your website, but it's not what you say routinely to prospective vaccinees. So you're being less than completely honest. Instead of what you feared, which was that your critics would seize on the 5% if you admitted it, what the critics do is they seize on your dishonesty. And they say things like, well, what the public health professionals don't want you to know is, what CDC isn't telling you is, what your doctor won't tell you is. And they talk about the other 5%. And they not only get the value of the 5%, they get the value for them of your having been less than candid. So, in my judgment, that's what's been going on in public health for the last several decades. Maybe longer than that, but I've been watching it for the last several decades. You know, public health people, on some vaccines, they're 80% right. On some vaccines, they're 95% right. On some vaccines, they're 99.9% right. Almost all the evidence is on their side. But they ignore or suppress or de-emphasize the small part of the story that goes against them. And their critics seize on that to undermine their credibility. That's not the fault of their critics. Their critics are doing what critics are supposed to do. That's the fault of the public health profession for not trusting the public with the whole truth. I think public health people often will say to me, the problem is that the public doesn't trust us. And my answer is always, no, that's not a problem. I mean, it's true that the public doesn't trust you, but that, you know, that's healthy. That's good. It's not good for the public to trust the government. It's much safer if the public looks at the government with considerable skepticism. And public health is a governmental function. So the problem isn't that they don't that the public doesn't trust you. The problem is that you don't trust the public, and you're trying to shape the truth instead of simply revealing the truth. And people get that. They sense that. Some, you know, the critics get it in detail, and they can give you long lists of things you've been dishonest about. The general public doesn't get it in detail, but they just sense that they're being managed instead of informed. And that exacerbates their skepticism, it exacerbates their suspicion, it makes them much likelier to give your critics a sympathetic hearing. I think there may be some truth to the claim. I mean, it's a claim I've heard before that people are getting more sophisticated about their science. People have better educations. People have better access to scientific information. So the superficial explanations that public health professionals and other experts used to give. That used to be satisfactory are perhaps less satisfactory now than they once were. But I think there's some truth to that. I don't think it's a major factor. I think there's still plenty of people who know very little, but they have a pretty good shit detector. They don't know a lot of science, but they know a lot about other people, and they can sense when they're being given a balanced story and when they're being given half the truth. Half the truth is not fair. They're being given 95% of the truth. They're being given all of the truth that supports what public health wants them to do. And they're not being given the small piece of the truth that would lead them in the other direction. It's not mostly that they know more science. It's mostly that people are pretty good and have always been pretty good at noticing that they're being sold a bill of goods. I'm a communication expert. I'm not someone who can advise on which vaccines are really important and which vaccines are a good idea but not that important and which vaccines are, you know, not yet ready for prime time and not actually a good idea for most people. There are a lot of experts in vaccination, and I'm not one of them. But the problem with public skepticism about vaccination is not mostly a problem with vaccination. It's mostly a problem with communication. I think the core risk communication task, the thing that public health needs to redo in a major way, is exactly to trust the public more. At very high levels, especially, this is a matter of trust. I mean, if you're the World Health Organization, or you're the Centers for Disease Control, if you're a major player in vaccination policy and therefore in vaccination communication, you know the whole truth. If to take a very straightforward, very trivial, but very revealing example, it's estimated that about 36,000 people a year die of the flu. It's a soft number, it's a squishy number, and it varies substantially from year to year. But the CDC has for many years offered as a rough estimate of annual deaths from the flu, 36,000. in the United States. What the CDC doesn't routinely emphasize, it's not like they hide it, it's there on their website, but they don't routinely emphasize, is that 90% of those 36,000 people are over 65. And well over half are substantially over 65, that most flu deaths are very elderly, very sick people who didn't have a lot of years left anyway. And I don't mean that to sound callous. I mean, you know, elderly people also deserve to live as long as they can, and or at least as long as they want to. But if you're determined to persuade young people, young adults, and children to get vaccinated against flu, and you have lots of reasons to want them to get vaccinated against flu. I mean, it's good for their health. I mean, even if they're not going to die, you don't want them homesick for a week if you can help it. It's good for their grandparents' health because most elderly people who die of flu get it from younger people. It's good for the vaccine market. The more people get vaccinated, the more vaccine you'll have next year. So you have good, coherent reasons for wanting young people to get vaccinated. But if you say to a 30-year-old, 36,000 people a year in the United States die of flu, and you don't say most of them are as old as your grandparents, you're being dishonest. You're not lying, but you're being dishonest. So at a very high level, there is this conscious, intentional shaping of the truth. At a lower level in public health, you've just got public health officials who don't know the whole truth. And you know, when I see WHO or CDC consciously leaving some information out, and then I see, you know, state and local health departments following the CDC line or following the WHO line, I will often contact the people at a local health department that's issued a news release, and I'll say, well, you know, why didn't you point out X? Why didn't you point out Y? Why didn't you point out Z? And usually, not always, but quite often, they'll say, gee, I didn't know that. You know, the CDC emphasizes what it emphasizes, and a lot of local health people don't know the whole truth. The CDC does, but they're getting their talking points, the local people are getting their talking points from the CDC, and they may not actually know the whole truth. So they're not misleading, they're being misled, and they're passing it on. It isn't enough, and it shouldn't be enough. I mean, you know, I mean, these decisions are not, and I don't like that answer. I'm going to start that one again. I mean, it's natural for people for, you know, whose lifeblood is science to think that the science is the core of the issue. And, you know, you could argue about whether it's a good thing or a bad thing that people don't think like computers, they think like people. And that people are interested in more than the science. I think it's a good thing. I don't actually want people who make values decisions based entirely on scientific data. It seems to me, for example, that the relationship we're talking about, that if I know you lie a lot or distort a lot and don't trust me with the whole truth, that makes me not want to buy your product. I think that's a healthy algorithm. I mean, if you know that the used car salesman is a crook, you know the used car salesman has been indicted for fraud, you don't test drive the car. You know, you take the dishonesty of the salesman as a very good indication that you shouldn't buy that person's car. You know, now, that's not good science. I mean, good science would say, ignore the fact that the salesman's a crook and make your own judgment about the quality of the car. But we cut corners. We have algorithms. We have shortcuts. And one very sensible shortcut is don't do business with crooks. I don't think that's a bad mistake for people to make. So if public health is dishonest and we therefore decide not to buy their vaccines, that's bad science. I mean, because even though public health is dishonest, you know, in most cases, the vaccine is still much better off to have than not to have. So the sound scientific judgment would be, even though public health is consciously and intentionally misleading me, I'm going to ignore that and get vaccinated anyway. That would be the right decision, okay? But, you know, at least the technically right decision. But the humanly right decision is, you know, if once I figure out that you're dishonest, I'm not interested in your product line. there are at least two things going on. One thing that's going on, and the one that I've been emphasizing, is if you're 95% right and you're talking to people who know or might soon learn about the other 5%, it's good strategy to tell them about the other 5%, rather than leaving your opponents to tell them about the other 5%. Excuse me. And that's well established as a principle, not just of risk communication, but of any kind of communication. That, you know, I mean, lawyers understand that, that, you know, if you're on one side of a lawsuit and the other side is, you know, has a key fact they're going to use against you, you try and sap the value of that key fact and reduce the value of that key fact to your opposition by admitting it yourself proactively early in the interaction. That's very basic, and public health should understand that. That, you know, I mean, if you're talking to someone who's only going to hear from you, they're never going to hear from your opponents. They're never going to go on the web and look up, you know, vaccine and get access to anti-vaccination websites. They're never going to talk to a neighbor who doesn't let her children get all the vaccines. If you're very confident you're talking to someone that's in a sterile communication environment, then it's only an ethical question whether you should admit the other side's 5%. But if you're talking to someone who already knows the other side's 5% or is soon going to hear the other side's 5%, then it's a no-brainer. It's stupid persuasion as well as bad ethics. That's part of the issue. The other part of the issue is that even if you're not 95% right, you're 100% right. People's concerns are absolutely nuts. The things they're worried about are impossible. They are simply scientifically completely in the wrong. It's still unwise and unempathic and bad communication to ignore their concerns. And there's a set of things that risk communicators understand that you do with people who have high outrage that's mistaken. That's completely mistaken. We're not talking about the 5% now. You know, they're just flat out wrong. But they're worried and they're upset and they're unhappy and they're suspicious. And there are things you do. You listen to them, okay, to start with. You feed back at them that you've heard them. You're worried that if I give your child 9 vaccines within a short period of time, that somehow those vaccines will interact with each other and might cause autism in your child. Do I understand your worry right? And docs don't have time to do that very often, but they need to make the time to do that, because a parent who's worried and mistakenly worried is not going to be able to get past that worry if she feels that her doctor still doesn't hear the worry, isn't responding to the worry. So you have to listen and you have to feed back. Okay, and you have to be respectful of the concern. You have to say, I can understand why you might feel that way. A lot of people in my practice feel that way. You're not the first patient I've talked to who feels that way. There are websites out there that argue that, and a lot of people have found it a persuasive argument. So that before you rebut a mistaken proposition, you take seriously that it's not a stupid proposition, that your patient may be wrong, but your patient's not dumb. I think a lot of parents walk out of their doctor's office feeling that their doctor has just treated them as dumb. And that gets in the way of them realizing that their concerns about vaccines should be overpowered by the need to be concerned about the diseases. And then there are more systemic things that don't happen so much in the doctor's office as in public policy issues. One of the, to me, most stunning things about vaccine safety is that virtually all the effort to make sure vaccines are safe and to study safety and to identify possible problems with vaccine safety. Virtually all that work is in the hands of people who are deeply committed to vaccination. The CDC is in charge of both promoting vaccination and making sure the vaccines are safe. Okay. Well, you know, we used to have the Atomic Energy Commission simultaneously in charge of promoting nuclear power and making sure nuclear power was safe, and we finally decided that was a conflict of interest, and it made much more sense to have, nuclear safety in the hands of a different government entity than the promotion of nuclear power. We don't have vaccine safety in the hands of a different government entity than the promotion of vaccination. It's the same government entity. So the CDC winds up saying, get vaccinated, and people say, but I'm not sure it's safe. And the CDC says, well, it is safe. And the government says, well, how do you know it's safe? And the CDC says, because we've tested it, and we're sure it's safe. And people say, well, yeah, but you're the people trying to get me to get vaccinated. You know, how about somebody neutral who doesn't care whether I get vaccinated? Why don't you put them in charge of making sure it's safe? And these are very fundamental things that corporations understand and other arms of the government understand that public health still doesn't understand. Public health insists on being trusted and has done virtually nothing to build in accountability mechanisms so that people who don't trust the public health establishment can find out for themselves. I mean, I would much rather see vaccine safety in the hands of the FDA than in the hands of the CDC. But the FDA is probably too closely associated with the promotion of vaccines. An interesting question, and I don't know the answer, but I'll throw out the question. If you look at some of the misleading public service announcements that government has put out about vaccination, urging people to get vaccinated, which, again, I think is the right bottom line, is the right message in nearly all cases. I don't think they're urging something they shouldn't be urging, but they urge people to get vaccinated with one-sided messages. They oversell the efficacy of the vaccine. They under-address, the problems with the vaccine. So it's one-sided. If those public service announcements that are produced by the government had been produced by pharmaceutical companies for a medication produced for profit, I think the FDA would have taken them off the air as dishonest. I'm not sure that's true, but my sense is that the FDA takes very seriously making sure that a pharmaceutical company, you look at pharmaceutical ads and they have all that small print about the contraindications and the disadvantages, and it's only 75% effective, not 100% effective, and it doesn't work very well in this group and this group, and you shouldn't do it if you have this problem or that problem, and all of that the FDA requires pharmaceutical manufacturers to put in every ad. Okay. Those requirements are not imposed by the government on the government when it's saying get vaccinated. This gets complicated. Yeah. If people are wrong, they're wrong. If they make a claim that's mistaken, the claim is mistaken. And it's never good risk communication to tell people they're right about something that you think they're wrong about. I mean, it's not sustainable in order to reduce their outrage to tell them they're right. On the other hand, it doesn't reduce their outrage if you keep rebutting the ways in which they're wrong as the only kind of communicating you do with them. While I'm not saying the government ought to validate mistaken claims, I am saying the government ought to treat and public health ought to treat mistaken claims respectfully and ought to validate the parts of those claims that are valid as a much higher priority than rebutting the claims that are not valid. And this is not for me an ethical precept. This is a strategic recommendation that, and if people are upset and angry and your main message is to persuade them slowly that they're wrong about A, B, and C, which are major issues that you're absolutely sure they're wrong about. Okay, you have to start out by pointing out some of the ways in which they're right. Okay, even though you're wrong about A and B and C, you know, you're right about X and Y, and you're right that we haven't been as candid about X and Y as we should have been. And it's really understandable why you've come to think that A and B and C might also be true, given that, you know, we were less than honest about X and Y. So you know, in owning up to the to them being on the having truth on their side with regard to X and Y, you significantly increase the probability that they can get it, you know, that you're right about A and B and C. It's still a tough sell. It's, you know, I mean, it's hard to change other people's minds. And, you know, I mean, very often if you're a public health professional and you're interacting with a vaccination opponent, you know, it's not usually your goal to change the opponent's mind. Just as it's not usually the opponent's goal to change your mind. You know, they're pretty sure you'll continue to be a vaccine supporter. You're pretty sure they'll continue to be a vaccine opponent. But there are people listening to that dialogue who are torn, who are ambivalent. They're on a seesaw. Who's right? Are you right? You know, are the critics right? And what I think huge numbers of ordinary citizens who are vaccination skeptics but not vaccination opponents, what they're looking for is for public health to validate that the critics are partly right. Okay? And if you validate that the critics are partly right, then if I'm in this ambivalent position, if I'm in the seesaw role, I'm much more able to notice the ways in which you're trying to tell me the critics are wrong. Absolutely. I mean, the single strongest weapon in the armamentarium of vaccination opponents, the strongest tool in their toolkit, is the fact that public health is less than totally candid. And what virtually all vaccination opponents focus on is the piece of the story that public health is hiding or distorting or misleading about. And it's not just that they tell that corner of the story, they talk about the dishonesty as an important reason why you ought not to listen to your doctor, you ought not to listen to public health, and you should listen to us, you know, listen to the opposition instead. So, I mean, they are very skilled at taking advantage of the risk communication errors of the public health profession.